We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have here again on the program David Sino. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Once a month on a Friday, he's here and we talk about personal finance. And he begins by making a few comments, sometimes has something to say about the economy or maybe some other topic specific to financial planning. And then if you have questions about that or anything else that has to do with your specific situation, you're thinking about your investments, your financial strategies, you can call in and Dave will give you his opinion on whatever the matter is. So that's it. That's how we get started. And actually, the way we get started is to say good morning, welcome back.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Basically, I intend to cover two topics in my introductory comments. First, I want to demystify Roth IRAs and especially the 2010 conversion opportunities involving Roth IRAs. And secondly, I think we should spend some time at a monthly look at our couch potato portfolio. All right, let's start with the basics of a Roth IRA to begin with. A Roth, of course, is a special type of individual retirement account. Now, in order to establish a Roth IRA, an individual first and foremost needs to have earned income, which is payroll income or self-employment income. Interest income, dividend income, for example, investment, rental income are not characterized as earned income. But if you do have earned income, you may be eligible to establish a Roth IRA. Of course, if you have too much earned income, in other words, you are beyond certain amounts of what are called modified adjusted gross income, you exceed certain limits, what we'll talk about in just a moment, then you're not eligible. So you sort of are or you're not. Now, in 2009, contributions are phased out. In other words, you can't make a Roth IRA contribution if your modified adjusted gross income exceeds $120,000 and you are single. If you are under $105,000 and you are single, then you can make a full Roth contribution. And for married folks, the phase out is $176,000. And if you are under $166,000, then you can make full Roth IRA contributions, again, assuming you have earned income. Now, there's a funny term. It's called modified adjusted gross income. But for most of us, modified adjusted gross income is going to be that figure that appears at the bottom of page one of your 1040 tax return, and that's the AGI, or adjusted gross income figure. Now, if you don't qualify, well, you simply cannot participate in a Roth IRA program. But if you do qualify, then you have the opportunity to contribute up to $5,000, so long as you have $5,000 of earned income. That's pretty straightforward. And then if you are an older person, that is, you can put in an additional $1,000. And apparently, IRS now considers old people over 50 years of age. So, David, that makes me a very, very old person. I won't mention how old you are. You would have to state that yourself. But in any event, for someone over age 50 and falls within these income limits, they could actually contribute up to $6,000 per year into an IRA program, and that is a Roth IRA program. Well, where do I establish one of these things? How do I go about even getting involved in a Roth IRA, if indeed I'm eligible? Well, you really can establish a Roth IRA with almost any eligible, which is an IRS-approved provider. Typically, that's all the banks, all the insurance companies, all of the credit unions, the brokerage firms, and the mutual fund companies. Just about anyone who provides you with some kind of investment product, they're probably eligible providers for purposes of a Roth IRA. Well, what is the perceived advantage of a Roth IRA? The real advantage is that your contributions grow in a tax-free environment, not a tax-deferred environment like a 401k, like a traditional IRA, but a tax-free environment. In other words, one, you're getting the beauty of compounding, and two, you are compounding your money in a tax-free environment. Now, that makes sense because the original contributions that you put into a Roth IRA are after-tax contributions. In other words, you earn income, you pay taxes on that income, you have money left over, it's called after-tax money, and you contribute that into a Roth IRA program. But the beauty of these programs, at least under the current law, is that your contributions and the growth on those contributions grow tax-free forever. Better yet, you never have to withdraw the money, even when you are 70 and a half. Now, in a traditional retirement program, like an IRA, like a 401k, maybe a 403b, when you hit that magic age of 70 and a half, you have to take what's called a required minimum distribution. But that's not the case in a Roth IRA, whether you're 80, 90, or perhaps you even live to 100. That means a lot because those dollars continue to grow in a tax-free environment, and then your beneficiary of your Roth IRA is really going to inherit a very substantial sum. Now, keep in mind, a Roth IRA is treated as a retirement account. Therefore, you should generally take only what is called qualified distributions from even your Roth IRA account. Well, what in the world is a qualified distribution from a Roth IRA? It's pretty simple. The first rule is you're supposed to wait until you're 59 and a half years of age. And secondly, the Roth needs to be around at least 5 years from the date of the first contribution. So if you're a younger person and you've been contributing to a Roth IRA and you wait at least till 59 and a half, presumably that Roth program is at least 5 years of age. It's at least 5 years old. And as a result, any monies that you would take out of that Roth IRA at age 59 and a half are free from income tax. You don't have to take the money out, but if you do, it's free from income tax. Now, a lot of people have been closed out from participating in a Roth IRA because they are fortunate enough to have made too much money. They have too much income. But interestingly enough, the rules have changed, and beginning January 1, 2010, things get a lot different. For example, prior to 2010, many people simply couldn't establish a Roth IRA because, as I mentioned, they earned too much money. However, beginning January 1, 2010, anyone can convert existing traditional IRA programs, old 401ks, old 403bs, and other retirement accounts into a Roth IRA, regardless of your income. Of course, the moment there is a conversion, there is an income tax consequence. Because if you've been saving in a tax-deferred environment or getting tax breaks for putting money into your retirement program, and now you're going to convert that to a tax-free Roth IRA environment, well, IRS isn't going to sit idly by. They're going to insist that you pay tax. But fortunately, IRS and Congress has given us a little bit of a break in paying the taxes. And probably the easiest way to explain this is by way of an example. Let's say you're retired and you have $100,000 in your 401k. It's been growing in a tax-deferred environment. You made contributions to the 401k and you got a tax break even on those contributions. Now, in 2010, after a very happy and pleasant new year, some winning football games, you decide to convert all of the $100,000 to a Roth IRA. Since you are moving money from a tax-deferred vehicle into a tax-free vehicle, the entire $100,000 is going to have to be reported on your tax returns, and it's going to be subject to tax. However, IRS allows a special election in 2010 where you can defer the amount that you're going to owe, so you only have to pay one half the tax burden on your tax return in 2011 and the remaining half in 2012. In other words, if on the date of conversion you converted exactly $100,000 on your 2011 tax return, you would report $50,000. And on your 2012 tax return, you would report another $50,000. And in 2010, it's deferred. So why? Can't answer that question, but it's a nice program in terms of a tax deferral. Now, the amount that will be reported on your tax return to determine the taxes owing is based simply on the value of the account on the actual day you convert. So when you convert, if it's $100,000 pouring into a Roth IRA, that's the $100,000 that you're going to have to report in tax years 2011 and 2012. Now, a threshold question is, well, heck, does it make any sense to convert? And you would think at first blush, well, of course, especially if I'm going to be in a low tax bracket and I'm a young taxpayer, then clearly this is going to continue to compound in for a very long time in a tax-free environment. But the truth of the matter is that it's a lot more difficult situation and a lot more complicated than it appears at first blush, and it really depends on a number of factors. And I'm just going to list a few of them. So what I would suggest to you is if you are considering a conversion, please sit down with your tax professional or your financial professional to make certain this makes good sense in your particular circumstance. For example, are you likely to be in a higher tax bracket at the withdrawal stage? Then conversion would make sense. So in other words, if you are looking at higher and higher taxes in the future, and we can move money today when you are in a lower tax bracket into a tax-free environment, well, then it very well makes sense. On the other hand, if you're going to be in a lower tax bracket when you retire, it may not make sense. Of course, that begs the question because we don't know future tax brackets. But in my view, if someone put a gun to my head, and I usually don't speculate, but I'm going to speculate just a little bit, it strikes me that as we continue to have these mushrooming deficits, not only on an annual basis, but these mushrooming national debts, now in excess of $12 trillion, it strikes me that the government and IRS is going to continue to have a voracious appetite for money. And again, I think tax brackets are likely to go up as opposed to even stay the same or go down. And indeed, even in 2010, there are some automatic changes that are going to push tax brackets higher. Secondly, do you have the money to pay the taxes from other than the converted funds? So if we're going to take $100,000 of 401k funds, put them in a Roth IRA, and now we have $100,000 in a Roth IRA, and we find out a couple of years later we owe $25,000 in taxes spread over 2 years, have we got a separate pile of money so we don't have to take money from our Roth money to pay those taxes? If you do, then the conversion may make more sense. Third, do you need the money? If not, a Roth conversion may indeed make sense because there is no required minimum distribution. And hence, you can let these funds accumulate ad infinitum until the date of your death, and then you can pass these monies on to the beneficiaries or the heirs of your Roth IRA. Will the conversion push you into a higher tax bracket? That's an interesting question. I convert. Now I'm going to be in an actually higher tax bracket. Does that make sense? Will it, for example, impact on the amount of Social Security that is subject to being reported for Social Security tax. So if I'm a retired taxpayer, I convert, I've now got more income, it may turn out that more of the Social Security I'm receiving is now subject to income tax. Maybe none of it previously was subject to income tax. Maybe only 50% of it was subject to being taxed. Now it may push me into having 85% of my benefits being reported, and I have to pay tax on those. Will I lose medical deductions or other kinds of deductions? Because if I itemize, I now have higher adjusted gross income, and I might lose certain itemized deductions. And probably most importantly, and this is really the $64 question that no one can answer, what's going to happen in the future to Roth IRAs? What if I go ahead, have this enormous sum of money now in my Roth IRA, and suddenly Congress says, sorry, well, it used to be tax-free, but we can't do that anymore. Some or all of it is now going to be subject to tax. And that's very possible in light of our government's insatiable appetite for tax revenue. So that's an open question. That remains to be seen. And that's why I caution everyone before they just rush in and suddenly convert old tax-deferred accounts into a Roth IRA, you really need to sit down with a tax professional and have these questions answered. All right, let's switch very, very quickly our focus and update our couch potato portfolio. We all know it's on the WILL website. In fact, Harriet Williamson very graciously updated that portfolio just this morning. It consists of 8 stock indexes, and through last night's close, our couch potato portfolio is ahead approximately 30% year-to-date. That compares to our benchmark S&P 500, which is ahead approximately 24% year-to-date. The point I'm making, at least in 2009 through yesterday's close, diversification in your investments has paid off. And finally, David, I of course would like to take this opportunity to wish all of the friends of WILL and the listeners of WILL a very joyous holiday season. Well, there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to tackle questions on issues I've raised, or let's hear from our listeners and see what is on their mind as well.
Okay, and I just want to make sure people also know the web address. If you'd like to go to our website, it's WILL, W-I-L-L, will.illinois.edu. Go to the AM section, then go to Focus 580, and over on the side you'll see Focus 580 links, and one of them says David Sinnoh's Couch Potato Portfolio. So if you click on that, you can see it. We have a caller here ready to go. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. First caller is in rural St. Joe, line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thanks for the comments. On the Roth conversion, the Vanguard website has several wonderful papers and a lot of information on the Roth conversions and a lot of good stuff for folks to be aware of.
That's excellent.
And so in our case, I'd like to talk about that, and also like, if I could, just talk a few minutes on the federal estate taxes. But on the Roth conversions, my wife and I, we have traditional IRAs, and the RMDs are almost all of it is taxable, and they're not needed, and we just reinvest them in taxable accounts.
Yes.
So we're in we're 75 in good health, and according to IRS pubs, we have a life expectancy of 24 years, which I think is a little too much. But anyway. So based on our age and good health, what's your opinion of us converting portions of the traditional IRAs to the Roth? And I should add, we plan to convert only as much as we can pay the resulting taxes and stay within our
marginal tax rate that you're currently in.
We're in 25%.
Okay. And I don't think you're ever going to be in a lower tax rate.
No.
And, in fact, you may be in a higher tax rate.
Yes.
So I don't have an issue with you if, one, you don't need the money, two, this is basically legacy money, and three, that you are not going to essentially exceed your highest marginal tax bracket without the conversion to the Roth. So I don't have a problem with that.
Excellent. Okay.
Okay. Something else, if you are an Illinois taxpayer, interestingly enough, that when you take monies out of your IRA, as you know, you're not paying state income tax on those.
Oh.
All right. So that's an added advantage. In certain other states, however, you convert, and that money is also taxable for state income purposes.
Oh, great.
So it makes a difference, and that's why it's so important to sit down with your professional advisor to see how this impacts you, especially if you are not a resident of the state of Illinois or a resident of a state where it does impose state income tax.
Great. And a related question, is the conversion recommended to be like in the latter part of 2010 so we know how much savings we have to pay the taxes, or any other considerations we should consider on the conversion?
Well, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. I don't think there is a great time. A lot of people are doing it early in the year under the theory that, gee, I've moved this money into a tax-free environment. It compounds longer, and then I really don't have to pay taxes for a very long period of time on this money. If you wait until December, of course, then you've lost 11 months of that tax-free compounding period. But that's a matter of individual choice, individual circumstances. And again, I think if you are concerned about bumping up and beyond your marginal tax rate, then you may be waiting a bit longer in the year.
Okay. Any pros and cons we should consider other than I know you had some great considerations?
Well, one, if you're taking Social Security,
yeah,
in which I presume that you are, then you've got to be careful that it doesn't bump you up. Are you paying Social Security at 85%? Are you reporting 85% of your Social Security currently?
Yes, we are.
Okay. So it really doesn't matter for you. So there really isn't a Social Security issue. If you have very large medical bills, it may have an impact on how much medical you can deduct. Are you itemizing?
No.
All right. If you're not itemizing, then it's really not an issue. So if you're not itemizing, it's not impacting your Social Security that you have to report, then I really don't have a problem.
Yeah. And do you concur in continuing the conversions in the future until we convert all the traditional IRAs to Roth?
Well, again, I think that depends on your individual circumstances, but if nothing changes and you're staying in that 25% bracket, I would not have a problem with that.
Okay.
As long as your investments are staying the same, I presume.
Okay. And my last question has to do with federal state taxes. I understand that the U.S. Congress is considering legislation that would permit a state smaller than $3.5 million to be exempt.
Correct.
From inheritance taxes and not applicable to family-owned farms. And we have a family-owned farm. Our estate is far below $3.5 million. Therefore, does it make sense for us to have a trust?
It makes sense to have a trust if—is your joint estate below $3.5 million?
Yes.
Well, and everything I presume that you have now is currently in joint tenancy with a right of survivorship?
Correct.
Is that what you have? Do you have your house, your personal residence, in joint tenancy by rights of entirety?
Actually, that is currently in a trust.
All right, that is in a trust. I prefer trusts because they are private documents. They avoid probate. If you've left something out, then you have to go through the probate process. It's private. It's not terribly expensive. And I think there are some benefits for it. Is it absolutely necessary? No. Not with a joint estate under $3.5 million.
Okay. Thanks for your time.
All right, thank you.
My pleasure.
Good holiday.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is David Sineau. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello. I have a small amount of money I had in a Roth IRA, and I bought some shares of General Motors stock before they went bankrupt. Now, is that worth anything at all, or is that zero? And if it is zero, is there any way one can deduct it from taxes or list it as a loss of any sort? Or is
can't list it as a loss.
Roth,
no, you can't list it as a loss. There's no deduction for it. It's inside a Roth IRA. It just simply means that the value of your Roth IRA has decreased in value. That's all it means.
No.
So you're out of luck.
Yeah, the stock isn't worth any, it will never be worth anything once they went bankrupt. Is that the case?
Well, that seems to be the case. That seems to be the case. Most instances where a company goes bankrupt, the shareholders are the first to lose. They have the lowest priority. It's usually the judgment creditors, of course, the courts, IRS, and the lawyers. They're the people who stand in line first. If there's anything left over after everything is said and done in a reorganization, then in certain instances, the shares have some value.
Okay.
All right. Let's go to Seidel. Next, line three. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
You gave the example of converting $100,000 Roth IRA. Can one convert part of it and leave the rest in a SEP IRA, which I have, say, $50,000, and do it later on in future years? And second question, how long is this deferment program? Is it just for the...
Those are great questions. Mm-hmm. Those are wonderful questions. First of all, by all means, that you don't have to convert all. You can convert some. But you also have to be a bit careful, because if you are employed currently and you are retiring, and let's say that you have $100,000 in a 401k and you move it, you have to move all of it in one calendar year. On the other hand, if you are retired and you're just sitting on some retirement money, then you can certainly convert it partially at a time. The point of doing more in 2010 is you have this one-time opportunity to defer the taxes into the 2011 and 2012 tax years. That's the only difference. So let's say that you converted $25,000 of the $100,000 in 2010. You could pay the tax on the 2010 tax return, or you could defer it and pay half of it on the 2011 and half of it on the 2012 tax return.
Okay.
Then the next year, let's say we're now 2011, and you say, I'm going to defer another $25,000. I'm going to put another $25,000 into my Roth IRA. All right? All of the tax on that particular transaction would be due and payable on your 2011 tax return.
I see. Okay. And this is, you don't see in your crystal ball them lengthening this out the next couple of years. This is just good for...
That would really surprise me.
Okay.
It frankly surprises me that the way the tax is going to be calculated, because what really is happening is, let's say that you did indeed place $100,000, you converted $100,000, you would think that that tax would be figured based upon your 2010 tax return, but it's not. It's figured based half of it on your 2011 and half on your 2012. So you're getting a little bit of a marginal tax break by the way IRS is enabling us to figure the tax.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I needed to know. Appreciate
the
time.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
On again, next is someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Thanks for this topic. I happen to have some questions about it. I think my husband and I are good candidates for this conversion. We're retired, and we have old traditional IRAs that we stopped contributing to in favor of other Roth IRAs. And but nobody addresses where to put the money, what sort of vehicle. Currently, the traditional IRAs are in Vanguard Wellington.
A great fund, I might add.
It's done well in light of all the craziness, the ups and downs.
Absolutely.
And can you convert it from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA and leave it in Wellington Fund?
Well, what you can do, and Vanguard can help you out with this, is you could actually do this online. You could fill the paperwork out online, establish the Roth IRA, and then you could actually do one of two things. Either you could liquidate the portion that you are desirous of placing in the Roth and going to cash on day one, and then on day two, moving that money right back into the Vanguard Roth and repurchasing Wellington. Alternatively, Alternatively, it takes a bit longer period of time, but Vanguard can tell you how they would do this. They can actually transfer shares, I believe. So you could transfer Wellington shares from your traditional to Wellington shares to your Roth.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in the Vanguard platform, I think it's much easier to remain in the Vanguard platform.
Right. And we're thinking of that. Our son is encouraging us to put the Roth money at a little more risk because it grows tax-free. And we are conservative investors, so that's been hard for us.
Well, that's right. And one of the things about the Wellington Fund, obviously, is that because of its composition, it's certainly more conservative than simply buying a S&P 500 index or a total stock market index or a total international index. So, yes, part of this has to do with your own investment acumen and your comfort level mm-hmm. of what you feel comfortable with.
And if we were to do one of those indexes, would you do total or stay U.S. or increase our international holdings?
Well, I think, that's an issue of asset allocation, so I'm a little bit remiss to advise you over the phone. I think you've got to look at the totality of your investments. You might take a look at our couch potato portfolio on WILL. I think that's a very lovely portfolio, and it gives you a nice asset allocation.
And one clarification. Say we convert in January 2010, and I understand the options of you can pay half the tax load in 2011, the other half in 2012. But if in the meantime Congress raises tax rates for 2011 and 2012, are you then hit with the bigger rate, or is your tax burden calculated on that January 2010, and I'll make up a figure. So
that's a great question, and I brought this up with a local CPA this morning who's very, very talented, Marty Verdick at McGladrey Pullen, and I asked him this very question because I was still unclear on it. He did some very, very quick research this morning, and he tells me that let's just assume that in 2010 you converted $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
All right? On your 2011 tax return, you would report half of that conversion of $50,000. And on your 2012 tax return, you would report the other half of $50,000. Now, I can't tell you what those marginal tax rates are going to be. Are they going to be lower? I sort of doubt it. I think you'd probably
right.
agree with me there. Alternatively, of course, you could do the conversion and you could actually pay the tax in April of 2011 for your 2010 tax return.
Mm-hmm.
So you're asking a great question. It was sort of the question that was raised earlier by another caller. And one thing you really don't want to have happen, particularly, is when you convert to essentially bump yourself up to
right.
a much higher marginal tax rate.
Right.
That's an issue.
Right.
So you're...
But it's not locked in at 2010 tax rates.
Not unless you pay it.
Right, unless you pay it.
Exactly.
And another issue you raised that I had never thought about, we are currently not taking Social Security. But if in 2011 or 12 we were, then that would be another reason to pay the tax
Correct.
Bill.
Now. Is there a reason you're not taking Social Security? Are you fully insured under Social Security? Have you reached your full retirement
no.
age? Ah, okay.
I have not at all, and my husband has just hit 62.
Okay.
And it's going to be of such little consequence because of the university.
Yes, the offsets.
Thing.
The offsets.
The offsets,
yes.
Right. That okay. it hasn't seemed even worth thinking about.
No, it's not, because you would end up also, even if you took it, you would be giving it back.
Right.
Interestingly enough. So you, in your case, you would want to wait until normal retirement age.
Mm-hmm.
So if your husband is 62, his normal retirement age is probably 66
right.
under Social Security, and that's when he would want to start to grab it because he wouldn't have to give it back.
Isn't there still some offset?
Well, yes, there's going to be an offset, but why leave the money on the table regardless of what the offset is?
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
All right. Very good. Let's see. Next, we'll talk to someone on a cell phone, line two. All right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if we could kind of shift gears a little bit. My question's really on a completely different subject.
Well, that's fine.
I'm self-employed part-time, and this is the first year coming up that I'll be paying self-employment taxes, and I'm really, really nervous about it. And since it's part-time, we're not talking about a lot of money, maybe $5,000-$6,000, but I know the IRS is going to want their cut of that. So should I go ahead and spend the money to have, you know, like a CPA or someone like that handle it, or at least walk me through the process? Or are there maybe some good online resources that could help me prepare that for myself?
I'll be very honest with you. If you have a very simple tax return and you have earned income, do you itemize?
No.
Okay,
no.
You're going to take a standard deduction and exemption.
Right.
You could probably stop at a bookstore and buy TurboTax, buy TaxCalc. There are many, many good software programs that are out there. They cost, you need the simplest version. They cost about $30, and you could self-prepare the return. But here's what I want to make certain that you understand. If you have self-employment earnings, Social Security on those self-employment earnings are paid up to $106,800 of earnings. So let's say that you have $5,000 of earnings. Let's make it real simple. When you're self-employed, you're both the employer and the employee. So you are going to owe 12.4% Social Security tax on that money, 12.4. In addition, you're both the employer and the employee for purposes of Medicare tax, which is going to tack on another 2.9%. Bottom line, on that $5,000, the self-employment tax is 15.3%. So we're looking at a little over $750 on $5,000. So you want to make certain that you have set aside that $750 just to pay the self-employment tax. Now, remember, for example, that if you are basically are you a single taxpayer?
Yes.
Okay, as a single taxpayer, you are entitled to a standard deduction of $5,700 in 2009, and you're entitled to an exemption if you claim yourself of $3,650. So in other words, you don't owe any federal income tax until you have passed essentially $9,350 of income. Okay? So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So there is no income tax necessarily on this self-employment earnings, but there is payroll tax.
Right.
Understand?
Yes, that makes sense.
Okay.
And then I've also held a part-time job as well, because obviously I'm not surviving on $6,000 a year.
Obviously you're not. And isn't and so that paycheck is already being withheld for income tax, Social Security tax, and Medicare tax.
All right. And then but the income tax on the self-employment would that be figured separately?
Well, no, it's all going to be added together on your return. As I say, if you have a software package, it'll be all added together. All I'm simply saying is it's sort of sheltered by the fact that you're entitled to a $5,700 standard deduction and a $3,650 personal exemption.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll probably go ahead and take your advice and do that, then. That sounds like a good plan.
It is. It's very easy. It's menu-driven. It's very, very simple. And for someone who has a very simple return, you should have no problems doing that.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. It's our monthly show on money management. We always do it on a Friday, and our guest is David Sino. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And we'll go up next to Morton Grove, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. morning, David. And I wonder if you could tell me. I'll be 71 and a half on April the 17th, 011. And I was thinking about conversion in 2010. But I believe I have to make start making withdrawals in 2011.
You have to make a withdrawal the April 1 following the year in which you reach 70 and a half. So when are you reaching 70 and a half?
Exactly on April 17th.
April 17th of
011.
Of 011, you'll be 70 and a half or 71 and a half?
71 and a half.
Okay, so April 17th of 2010, you will be 70 and a half.
Dr. Seno made a mistake. I'll be 70 and a half at that point.
In 2011 or 2010?
11.
Oh, okay, 2011. So the rule is that you must take a minimum distribution by the April 1st following the year in which you reach 70 and a half. So you really could put it off to 2012 in terms of a minimum distribution. The problem with doing that for most people, if they put it off, they have to take two minimum distributions. They have to take the minimum distribution for the year 2011, in which you do reach 70 and a half, and then 2012. And that could put you into a higher marginal bracket. So your question is, should I consider converting some of this money in 2010 into a Roth? So the first point is that you don't have to take a minimum distribution out of your traditional IRA in 2010.
Yes.
So we know that.
Yes.
And the second question is, does it make sense? And again, I would suggest that you talk to a practitioner because of a lot of reasons. Is it going to push you into a higher marginal tax bracket? Do you need the money? Is it going to affect itemized deductions, et cetera? All these questions. And how much are we talking about?
Yeah, none of that applies, doctor.
Okay. So,
but the account probably has a something slightly over 100,000, and it's a combination of it's a traditional IRA, but it has both pre-tax money in it as well as post-tax money.
Ah, okay, that makes it a little bit more difficult because there is a separate calculation that has to be done for both pre-tax and post-tax. So, for example, let's say that 20% of that money was after-tax money. Then, and let's say the IRA was worth $100,000, then essentially $20,000 of that money is considered, or 20% is post-tax, and the remaining 80% is pre-tax.
Yes.
And then you have a formula that you utilize to see what occurs when you roll that money over. So you would need some special advice on that.
Yeah, I guess that is a special situation.
It is, although interestingly enough, many people seem to have that situation. I can refer you, I believe, to an example on a website. It's called MOOL1ANOMY.com. M001ANOMY.com, and then click on conversion rules, Roth conversion rules, and there actually is an example that shows you exactly what would happen if you have after-tax contributions and pre-tax contributions. They go through that for you so you can get an idea of how that would impact you.
And again, that was M like in Mary,
One. ANOMY dot com.
Okay. All right. I'll check that out.
Check it out.
Thank you for the help.
My pleasure.
Very good. And we'll continue. And the next person up here is on a cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I have a question about PMI mortgage insurance.
Yes.
Because I've been making extra payments on my mortgage, I've actually reached the threshold where the PMI insurance would go away under that the Homeowners Protection Act.
Right. In other words, you have at least 20% equity.
Right, I mean, I'm about 25 or closer to 30 now.
Okay.
My mortgage company is refusing to make it go away because they claim that I have not reached what they said that I had in my original agreement. It would go away based on the original amortization schedule for the loan. And because I'm ahead of that, because I've made the extra payments, they won't cancel it.
Now, that's something new. I'm not aware of that. My understanding has always been that if there is a new bona fide appraisal, and this would be an appraisal that would be ordered by the mortgage company, you just can't simply go out anymore and just provide them with an appraisal, that they should comply with those rules so long as you are showing at least a 20% equity posture in that loan. Now, I don't know the answer to that, and so they're refusing because you have essentially doubled down
and paid it off. An appraisal. I can get an appraisal, which would cost something like, under their thing, like $330-something.
Correct. That's about what they cost. That's about what they cost.
But I was just arguing with them that because I'd reached this percentage point by actually making extra payments, I wasn't claiming that the value of my home had increased to that point where my equity had reached that level, that it's got there because I physically paid the money down, but I didn't think an appraisal was necessary.
Absolutely.
I reached it by making payments
as opposed
to claiming the value of the home had changed. Yeah. But they're insisting I have to have an appraisal.
Absolutely. That is the case because today everyone is so gun-shy, especially because housing prices over most of America have actually dropped in value. So if you have an appraisal, we have to demonstrate that you still actually have at least a 20% equity position. Because if your house has dropped 10% in value, regardless, then you may not have a 20% equity position.
I calculated how many PMI payments I had and what they'd add up to and what the appraisal add up to, and they came out about the same because they said that within about 18 months, the PMI would go away anyway under their original schedule. It seems that it's kind of a wash between
yes.
an appraisal and just simply paying that. You know,
yes.
They kind of work out about the same.
All right. So you should get in writing from your mortgage company when the PMI will disappear.
Okay.
So make certain that you have that so that you can compare apples and apples, and based upon what you are paying, it's not a whole lot different than what the appraisal will cost you.
Oh, well, I guess I'll have to grin and bear it then.
All right.
Okay. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you. And again, we have one more caller here. This is someone in Normal, line number one. Hello.
Hey, hi. Great.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I would say I'm a small-time, really conservative investor, and basically about the only thing I've been willing to put my hands on are inflation bonds from the Treasury Department. And I've had a lot of fun with those. I think they've been paying pretty good.
Well, they've been doing well, and you're betting on future inflation. So actually, they are in some of my investment portfolios as well for some of my clients. So I think as a strategy, as part of your overall fixed income allocation, I don't have a problem with inflation bonds.
Yeah, I've been buying them since 2000, and sometimes I've been really surprised at the rates. I've been – well, right now, because there was a – I guess it was like during the middle of the year, they actually recorded deflation.
Right.
That wiped out my fixed rate.
Yeah, it wiped out your payments.
Yeah, so my notes were paying zero. But, man, right before that, man, it was like 7%, 8%. But I noticed it says they're backed by the full faith and credit.
Absolutely.
And so one thing I was wondering is, like, what are some things that we should look forward to? Is there, like, a crucial thing to analyze the markets to be like, okay, the full faith and credit – it's not what it used to be, such as, like, you know, Argentina, where they defaulted. Is there, like, a number to look for, like a debt to GDP or something like that, where you know it's like it's time to get out of here? And
well, I'm not willing to
turn over some real money.
No, I'm not willing to speculate. I think the government is going to stand behind these types of assets, whether they are Ginnie Mae's, Treasuries, inflation-protected bonds. The only issue is what is the purchasing power down the road when you cash that money in. That's an entirely different issue. But in terms of you getting paid on these by the government, they're going to pay. The question is, what's the paper worth? And only time will tell that. So by holding inflation bonds, if we have massive inflation, you get paid more. So it's not a bad strategy so long as you believe that in the future we are going to have very substantial inflation. So it's one piece of the pie. You sound very young, as I can hear children in the background. And I think at the same time that part of your asset allocation model should be some type of long-term commitment to some type of very broad index stock strategy, maybe
a total stock
market index.
Yeah, I'm thinking extremely long term. The monies I put aside, I don't really consider that I will ever use them. I'm trying to create some sort of a legacy portfolio where I'm thinking maybe one day if, you know, maybe not my children, but my grandchildren or my great-grandchildren, somebody's going to be living off of interest and not have to worry about work.
Well, that's right thinking. I call that right thinking. But again, it's more likely to get there with a diversified strategy that goes beyond just simply inflation-protected bonds. So I would urge you to consider allocating beyond just those bonds.
Okay.
Pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we are just about the point that we're going to have to finish because we've come here to the end of the time. Any last quick thing you might want to mention to folks?
Well, David, I see that the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates just about the same. They haven't made any big moves. So they're trying to convince people to borrow money, even though banks don't want to loan money. So that's sort of a bit of a quagmire, and it creates a very difficult investment environment for people on fixed incomes who are renewing CDs at 1%. What's a person to do? I think I'll address that more fully in our January get-together. And again, I want to wish everybody a very peaceful, pleasurable, and joyous holiday season.
I thank you very much, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, always here once a month on a Friday to do these programs on money management.